Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's direction is going to be so interesting because, as you may well know, we do a lot with people who write love letters to those who have passed. And the issue is where to send them. And anyway, it's a whole lovely but tricky issue. Today's guest is Robert Strong, a magician you may know. If you don't, I hope you get to see him someday. May I just go on about you for just a half a second?
Go on and on.
Thank you. I have seen Robert perform, and I'm telling you, I've seen him do things that can't be done. I actually saw him cut a man's tie in half, and then the man left. Robert finally sent him out with his tie fully attached again. But I've seen him do things with cards that cannot be done. So I'm going to go to you because I think he's going to be taking part in another thing, and you can talk about whether it's going to be done. You're putting together a seance, right?
Yes.
You talk.
So I have been a magician for 30 years. Back in 1985, I was a 12-year-old magician, and my family went on a road trip to Springfield, Massachusetts. And I did a little magic show for the family members, and an aunt pulled me aside and said, "You know, you're related to the person who inherited all of Harry Houdini's magic."
Oh, no. Is this recent news to you, or you've always known this?
Well, I heard that when I was 12, and I had just gotten magic, and it didn't have the weightiness, the gravitas to it, so it just kind of sat in the back of my brain.
Because I think you just referred to it recently.
Right. So what happened was I went back and visited my parents in Maryland, and we're sitting around looking at old pictures, and I recalled this memory and said, "Is it a myth? Did I misremember it? Did I make it up? Is it exaggerated?" And they had no idea. So I asked my parents to email everyone who's still living and ask them if they know if there's any connection that I have to Harry Houdini. And immediately we got emails back saying, "I'm related to Sidney Radner. He's my great grand uncle." And Sidney Radner was a great magician who inherited, collected, bought all of Houdini's magic, memorabilia, notebooks, photos, drawings, every little piece of scratch paper.
Is he still alive, this Radner?
No, in 2004, he auctioned off most of his magic,
ouch.
And it went to a buyer, an anonymous buyer who probably is David Copperfield. And then in 2011, he passed away. But his son, William Radner, Bill Radner, and his partner in producing the seance is Tom Bolt.
Okay.
And they've been putting together a seance on and off for the past 88 years.
Okay, so go ahead and talk about seance. So, and yours and theirs.
Yeah. So when I connect with them, they ask me if I want to produce the seance, co-produce with them the seance in San Francisco, and I said absolutely yes. Now, I am involved with a bunch of science organizations like the Bay Area Skeptics, Wonderfest, Bay Area Science Festival, and so they're all getting on board to help produce it and promote it.
And didn't you do some things with Ask a Scientist, or was
Ask a Scientist, and
with Juliana, who was your partner also in
Comedy Talks about 5 years ago.
Yes.
And Juliana has actually been very helpful in helping with the press releases, writing the script, and
you're such a good team.
Yeah, we work well together, and Tucker's great too. Tucker's my co-producer.
Yes,
the three of us, I think.
You're doing the seance through Wonderfest.
Yes.
Bay Area Science Festival
and Bay Area Skeptics.
Okay.
So the twist is, in the past, they just did a seance. This time, I'm looking to do a seance. I'm looking to do some science conversations and panel discussion, and then end with a very, very magical seance where we bring in a magician celebrity who will knock it out of the park and maybe turn some people into believers with his skill and ability.
But yourself, you don't really feel you can communicate with the dead.
So personally, I'm a skeptic.
Right.
And people that are involved are falling on all sides of the fence. I intend to remain a skeptic until I get some evidence otherwise. So I'm hoping on October 31st, Halloween, the day Houdini died, the day we're going to do the seance, I'm hoping he makes contact and changes my mind.
You're hoping who makes contact?
Houdini.
He with us now.
Yeah, with us.
He tried. He was going to do that with his wife.
Yes.
And that didn't work, did it?
Over the past 88 years, it's been unsuccessful. So I imagine we probably won't make contact with him, but it should still be a very educational and entertaining night.
What is going to go into it?
So,
I mean, will people have a chance actually to take part and try to contact?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So here's how it's going to unfold. We're going to launch a Kickstarter to pre-fund it, and the website that will be launched real soon is houdini-seance.com, and I'll have a link to the Kickstarter. And it's going to end around October 14th, so get in there quickly and donate. Donate early and often. And what we're hoping to do is fund about $9,000 to have the evening event where we bring in celebrity magicians, neuroscientists, data scientist, behavioral scientist, a self-described medium, a magician medium, and escape artist, and have a whole entertaining evening. But if we have if we're overfunded or superfunded, we have a stretch goal of about when we raise another $8,000 or $9,000 to have a day-long event where we have talks and magicians and entertainment.
That would give people more of a chance to take part.
They're going to participate by sitting at the seance table. They're going to ask questions to be passed along to Houdini and any special people they want to ask. And it's going to be interactive in the sense that magical things are going to happen to everybody in the audience. And that's a surprise, so I won't get too specific.
Okay.
And if we hit the stretch goal, it'll be a day-long event that they'll be able to see shows all day long. And if we super fund it and we get to about $24,000, $25,000, we're working with a documentarian. And he's going to videotape the day and do interviews, and we'll make a 45-minute YouTube video that's about the impact of Houdini then, now, and tomorrow, because Houdini was very impactful in his time to all of us magicians to this day, and I think for innovators and technologists, he's very influential.
Could we talk about Houdini for a few minutes?
Yes, I'd love to.
Okay, Houdini, my understanding, you hear about Houdini, magician, but my understanding is that he was not a magician, he was an escape artist.
So he started as a magician.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, very young magician, a very skilled magician.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started to really push his body to the limit with things like holding his breath and getting muscular and taking punches, mm-hmm. and being able to bend, twist, contort, or mm-hmm. fill up muscles so that it would take up extra space. So he really became someone who understood the physiology to be able to do amazing things. And he started to become an escape artist. Mm-hmm. He was fantastic, getting massive media.
Yes.
No one before him had ever been internationally famous the way he was, and able to stop a whole town and get the cover of every newspaper for every city.
Did you ever see the art exhibit, I think it was at the San Francisco Jewish Museum.
I did.
On Houdini?
I did. I was walking around reading every plaque trying to figure out how I might be related.
Oh.
And I thought I might be related to Jacob Hyman, and I was starting to do some research there. That was his magic partner, but it turned out
I'm laughing because
Sidney
you
Redder.
Go to these things with a slightly different agenda
yes.
than most of us.
I was hoping to find a family member's last name in one of the exhibits.
Well, I was struck by the fact that he too was a skeptic.
Yes. So,
and that I was really touched by that. It seemed to me that a lot of his thrust in life was to show people who were not real. I mean, to show them as frauds.
Yes. Yeah, so
talk
what happened
about that, because his sincerity was.
He was very earnest and very sincere. Later in life, he had made as much money as he needed to make, and mm-hmm. he was doing this for his because he was passionate about it, and also he was thinking about his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And what he wanted to do was he wanted to expose fake spiritualists because
right, there
it was
you go.
Very popular at the time to use magic tricks, magic methods to get people to believe that you are channeling, and they would take a lot of money because they would have unfinished business.
That's what I was trying to remember. Yes, thank you.
And so the more unfinished business apparently they had, the more it would cost for the medium to help clear up that unfinished business with the dead.
Uh-huh.
So people were getting
scammed
for everything that they were worth, and people really believed in it. And the science was so not mature that the scientists would start to study these fake spiritualists. And they were given awards, or they were rewarded money for proving that you can channel, because they were looking for evidence. They were not looking for deception. So Houdini was the only person on the panel. I don't remember if it was some national scientific mm-hmm. committee. He was the only non-scientist who was on the committee, and he was demonstrating that you had to look for fraud, you had to look for deception. And scientists are the easiest to fool.
Why?
Because they're looking for such simple, logical.
Oh, any positive connection will be impressive. Oh, well, he also, I remember this, and I don't know, you tell me if this is true. I read that in his whole escape artist life, when he was escaping from the insides of safes, and people were so impressed with everything he did, and I remember reading that he said, safes are meant to keep people from getting into, not out of.
I am smiling and nodding. Now we're getting into methods.
Okay.
And as a magician, I am interested in protecting and keeping the methods, so I won't answer one way or the other.
Oh, I know you won't tell a thing. But
however,
I mean,
he was a fantastic escape artist.
But I think that was an interesting tribute to how he thought.
Yes.
You know, and what he was willing to share. I mean, don't be silly. It's not so simple. It's not so difficult as you think to get out of one.
to get out of safe. But he did challenges where he would go to a city and sight unseen the police roped and chained and shackled and handcuffed and thrown to a cell almost naked, and he would escape. And he had his own methods for that too. And he's very sneaky.
I think a lot of us would love to know the secrets, and I know you're not going to tell them.
You really don't want to know. Everybody thinks they know.
That's right.
And they think they want to know, but they don't.
And that's the other part.
Yeah.
I don't really want to know. Yes. Okay. Because that'll take away the joy of it.
Yes. The mystery, the wonder, all, where you feel like a 9-year-old, that is all taken away forever the moment the method is revealed. So the best thing one can do is let people sit and enjoy that feeling of anything is possible.
Became aware yesterday of a man who had written a book called Phone Calls from the Dead. And I had sent that information to you. His name, last name was Rogo.
Okay.
And you had not heard of him, which makes sense. But there are so many people who purport to have experiences.
And what's really interesting
is that they use the phone is a little bit bizarre.
I agree. I think since the beginning of time, every person who has been tested has failed. And so at this point, there is no good evidence that we can channel the dead. People who claim to be able to do it usually don't show up for the test.
Oh, also, when we test people for something, we can only test what we know how to test for, which limits us.
There's pretty good tests that we can create. If someone claims that they can predict something, read a mind, if they can channel to the other side, we can create pretty basic tests.
Oh, yes.
That they will agree to.
Yes.
And then they will fail. And often when they fail, they come up with really great excuses. And the excuses justify in their mind that this time I failed, but every other time I'm successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that it's possible that there are planes of existence that we can't quite get a hold of as long as we are living in this one?
I think there's a lot of things that are possible that we can't understand, and it's so infinite it's up to our imagination, and I don't think all of them are true, so I withhold judgment.
And it doesn't have too much to do with most of our daily lives.
No, right. Mostly it doesn't. I think it would be difficult for me to imagine all the things that we can imagine that's possible are likely not. So I am withholding.
You're a practical person.
I'm a practical person.
Yes, okay.
I will believe that none of it exists until something is proven otherwise.
Sure.
And
Do you know people who have taken part in seances who have said that they have contacted the dead?
Yes,
you do. And what do they say about it?
It's a skill that you can hone and tune, and that they are. And they really believe it. So there's two types of people who channel the dead that
I
know.
They can do it privately. They don't have to go to a seance to do it.
No, they do
it
privately.
I say that because I knew a woman when I was a little girl who, horribly enough, had lost both her sons. And she spent her life communicating with them.
The brain is a really strange thing. I think there's two categories. There's people who are using trickery to deceive people. And then there's people who really believe it. And the people who really believe it, it doesn't stand up to the scientific test that we come up with. And I have a friend, I won't say his name because he hasn't given me permission to say this on the radio, but he feels that if he were to see God, it's statistically more likely that he has a brain malfunction than he actually sees God, because nobody has any proof of God's existence, and people all the time have brain disorders where they see things, hear things.
Oh, and follow those instructions to the
detriment follow those instructions of others, yeah.
Right.
So I think people can sincerely believe.
Or lead France to victory like Joan of Arc.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, you can hear voices in your head, and that doesn't make it true.
Right. It doesn't make it true. On the other hand, it's open for discussion, I would guess.
I think a good skeptic has an open mind, and when they get evidence, they change their mind to what is new. They're not trying to disprove something. They're trying
to... So you make a good point. So the perception of a skeptic as some grouchy, unapproachable, rigid person...
There's a lot of those, too.
Well, I understand that, but a good skeptic...
In my opinion, but everybody will disagree. There's a million types. There's 50 shades of skeptics,
skeptic,
at least.
Okay.
So if, just like there's... thousands of Christians, thousands of Muslims, and thousands of types of Jews, thousands of types of Muslims, thousands of types of Christians that interpret the same thing completely different. There's thousands of different types of skeptics, ones that are positive there's no God and you can't channel, and then there are ones that Don't believe it exists because we haven't proven it yet, but the moment you get new information, they'll let go of the old belief. Mm-hmm. And science is constantly updating, and as we get
open
better
skepticism
science,
seems to be kind of a nice place to stand.
Yeah.
I have a question that just occurred to me. Have you ever, as a magician, been asked to do anything that you felt wasn't ethical to do?
Yeah.
Like
I was
what
asked,
kind of things?
I was asked to do to promote cigarettes, and I said, no way, that's unethical. When I started to do mind reading, immediately, what I was doing was comedy, magic, mind reading. Immediately, people would come up to me in tears because they were sure that I had some kind of intuition that I honed and I could cross over and channel their dead grandparents and they felt something with me. Mm-hmm. And I would tell them, no, I'm using tricks. I'm using sleight of hand, misdirection. And they would argue with me and tell me that I was wrong. And so what I've done is I've constantly honed the wording that I say, mm-hmm. and it goes something like this. I do not have the ability to channel or to predict the future or to actually read minds. I am creating the illusion I can do that.
How do you create? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, through optical illusions, visual illusions, cognitive illusions. I do it through sleight of hand, misdirection.
What does that mean, sleight of hand, misdirection?
Well, I don't want to give away too much.
Okay.
But what I am doing is I have an acute awareness of where your focus and attention is.
Oh, I see.
And when your focus and attention is off me for a moment, I do something secret that you can't see. Even if you're visually looking at me, your gaze can be on me, but you don't see it. You don't comprehend it. And that is the moment where I do the sneaky stuff so that I can give the illusion I can read minds, predict the future.
Now, as far as mind reading goes, there are people who can really pluck thoughts right out of your head by all kinds of other cues.
Oh, I would agree with cues, not if the person's in an isolated booth right next to the other person, they can't see them.
Oh, right.
Cues like visual cues, like body language, gestures,
yes.
Facial expressions, uh-huh. That type of thing, yes. There's a really, you know what, I will teach your listeners something really fantastic.
Go ahead.
I usually don't divulge secrets, but this is going to change everyone's life. Cold reading is something that tarot card readers, palm readers, psychics do. It. Usually they're aware of it. Sometimes they're not aware they're doing it. But it's looking at a person based on what they're wearing, how they carry themselves. And it's basically pulling a Sherlock Holmes. It's using intuition cues to discern information that otherwise seems to be secret. So here's the shortest distance. In about 30 seconds, I can teach all your listeners how to be good cold readers to do what Sherlock Holmes does. And there goes the trolley. I can teach them what Sherlock Holmes does and what all the good tarot, palm, mm-hmm. and psychics do. You look at a person without thinking too hard. Think of one, two, or three people that they remind you of. A cousin, an aunt.
Of your own.
Of your own, from your own mm-hmm. life. And then what you do is you start to describe those people and you'll get more than a 50, 60% correct hit rate. So if I look at you and I look at how you're dressed and the colors you're wearing and you remind me of someone, I would say that you're someone who has a kind heart. You're someone who likes to listen.
Oh, and everybody wants to believe that that's true.
Well, they
want
to believe that's true, but I can start to tell you other more specific things.
I'm guessing that if you were to look at a woman in her early 20s who looks particularly sad and she's got nails bitten down, and you could go right for, is there a love gone wrong?
Yes, absolutely.
And probably get very close to, yes.
Well, you start with something vague where you're concerned about a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's someone you're very close to. They'll say yes. And you say it's a love. And then you start to go, it's a romantic love or it's a family love. And you can kind of just
keep
honing in.
And you can see where eyes change. You can
yes.
see where pupils dilate.
Nodding is a really big one. People uh-huh. aren't aware of the fact they're nodding.
Yes.
And you can give open-ended things where it's true for everyone.
That sounds like what a good therapist would do.
A good
also.
You know, I'm not
Look,
in that industry,
I know,
so I should probably
I mean,
not give any opinion
well,
on that.
Just looking at cues and helping
yes.
the person express.
The thing is, a therapist has training, a palm reader, tarot card reader, a psychic, one of the kind of psychics with the neon lights that are open 24/7. The only training they have is the fact that they have a neon light.
Yes.
And maybe people should not be making life decisions about investments or love based on the fact that they can afford a neon light.
Oh. My goodness. Okay, good advice. Good advice. I have a question about love letters.
Yes.
And writing to one of the things you said was, well, you know, I forget. I should have written it down. I kind of forget what that was. But writing letters is a very definite way of communicating a very definite and satisfying way of communicating with those who have passed.
I think it's any type of letter writing, whether the letter gets mailed to someone living or gets not mailed to someone living or not mailed to someone who's passed on, is very cathartic for the writer of the letter.
Well, and you actually do, you actually are communicating. I mean, you're doing it in your own head.
You communicate it to yourself, the future you.
Or, well, you can do that also. But, you know, I know that when I've written letters, I've written a couple of letters to a people who have gone. And I'm in the midst of one. I'm going to send it to her son. Because they should go somewhere.
Yeah.
And, I mean, while I am writing this thing, I am surely talking to her.
Yeah.
Totally satisfying. And is she talking back to me? Well, I can picture what she would say.
I think it's getting a lot off your chest so that it's not weighing you down and having some kind of closure.
Just the joy of... Oh, I mean, this
expressing
is,
too.
By
yes.
the way, this is a death that took place 40 mm-hmm. some years ago. So closure is closure. That's not the issue. The issue is just the human desire to stay connected with people we love.
What?
Well, have you ever thought of writing a letter to this relative? A love letter to this relative?
I hadn't thought of that, but I was going to say every time somebody writes a love letter, it's a little piece of art.
Oh,
it's a little
sure.
It's a little piece of poetry, a little piece of future history. I think that it is being creative and productive in a way that is good for the brain.
When you say piece of history, that's, by the way, if I may,
yes.
just jump right in. That's critical in letter writing because whatever, and I was going to ask you about that. Now, does this person have children?
The person I'm related to, Sidney uh-huh. Radner, yes. William Radner is the one who's continuing it with his co-producer, Tom Bolt, and I'm working
right.
with both of them.
Okay. If you were to write a letter, just consider a letter to this person, just indicating, just stating out what it meant to you to discover that you have this connection.
We are emailing, but you're right. I should write a formal letter on paper.
Your handwriting.
A pen. Yes, yes.
Because handwriting is a magic all its own. That carries a lot. And I'm just thinking, just like I groaned to think that these letters had been auctioned off, all this memorabilia, can you imagine what it will feel like in two generations for some great-grandchild to find this?
I think it's incredible, and people are already
and have in their hands something that has felt the touch of yours.
I think it's great, but let me challenge you on something there.
Go ahead.
When someone finds a letter mm-hmm. that's handwritten a generation or two generations later, do you think that they're really interpreting history accurately, or do you think they're projecting their own biases, needs, and on that? And the reason I say that...
The person who wrote the letter?
The person who's reading the letter is interpreting it.
Not if you make it clear enough.
You know, two people reading the same letter, I think maybe could have two interpretations. The reason I say that is I heard a great saying recently, is the viewer of art, and I'm going to mangle it, the wording of it, the view of the art is actually getting a reflection of themselves. When you view the art, the interpretation is a reflection of where you're at. And so I imagine that these letters can be interpreted to fill each person's needs differently.
They could. And if you say something like, you know, you're so special or vague things, but if you were to really fill in, I remember when I was 3 years old and I first heard that we were related, it sat there for 30 years before I realized I should do something with it.
Right.
And if you have factual letters, facts in the love letters.
So very clearly written. Good.
Yes.
I think I learned
And then you've
too.
Left a wonderful piece of history.
Yes.
That is filled with your admiration and affection, not only for your relative, but for the whole field. Oh, I think that, I mean, I do tend to plan for when I'm not here. Because haven't we all found letters and learned something? And by the way, the best history is always from letters. The rest is guessing.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
I think we should start writing right now.
Well, what would you say?
To my great-granduncle, Sidney Radner?
Yes. And you could say, by the way, if you're writing to him, actually, dear Uncle Sidney, I'm writing this to you, but I'm going to mail it to...
Right.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, I think I would say I'm very impressed with... his passion, and I would say that he's done a great job honoring Harry Houdini, which I know he made that promise to his wife, to Houdini's wife, Bess. And I think that he is...
Your uncle made that promise to
Houdini? Yes, and he kept the promise, and his son is keeping that promise.
Okay, so it might be nice to include exactly what that promise was and how he kept it. I mean, real specifics.
Yes.
If you're going to leave a piece of history, you're a big part of the history of magic.
And right around the same time I found out about great-grand-uncle Sidney Radner, I found out that my grandfather on my father's side, Benjamin Strong, who I knew until I was about 28, 29 years old, and I was a magician from age 13, I found out he was also a magician. So I knew him a good part of my life, and he never once said he also did magic. So after he passed away, I found a photograph of him where he worked at Milton Bradley pulling a rabbit from a hat for a Halloween magic show. So this is happening on Halloween. It's all coming together. Apparently there's magic in my blood.
Yes.
I got into it when I was 12, and I didn't even know there was magic in my blood. So
okay,
I found it on my own.
There's a whole other letter of gratitude for
to another grandfather. Yes.
Genetically. Was there anything written on the back of that photograph?
No, it's just a old sepia photograph of him pulling a rabbit from, I think it was a hat or a pumpkin, because the hat and the pumpkin were side by side, and the rabbit was already out. And he had a lovely assistant, and there was a cheering audience, and it was a great photo.
So you were slated to do this from way before birth.
Yes, and I could recreate that photo, because I look like a young version of my grandfather.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope you do it. I'm big on people writing letters, love letters, with their own history involved in it.
Yes.
That is really something to find later. Well, thank
you. I've
got
a lot to write now.
Pardon?
I've got a lot to write now.
You do.
Yeah,
you do.
Thank you.
Tell us again when the seance is going to be.
It's going to be October 31st, Halloween 2015, in San Francisco at the Brava Theater, which used to be called the Roosevelt Theater, which Houdini performed that in 1926.
Where is that?
That is on 24th in the Mission at About Bryant or Folsom.
People get tickets through your website?
Yes, that's www.houdini-seance.com. I'll spell that because those are words that people don't use every day. It's Houdini and hyphen, and seance is Seance.
Good. Now, I had a question. You know, when you're spelling Harry Houdini's last name, he named himself after a
Robert Houdin. A French magician.
That he admired a lot and then later was sad to find out was a fraud, right?
I don't know about Robert Houdini being a fraud. He was a magician.
But I read that in Houdini's biography.
I'll have to go back and look at that.
Okay.
But I know he was honoring Robert Houdin by adding I-N-I, which was implying little Houdin. So Houdini was little Houdin.
Okay, well, let's put that on, the maybe list because
yes.
I don't want to be spreading nasty rumors.
Yes, I'll look that up also.
Okay. One other thing is, okay, so people can get tickets.
Yes,
to this.
They can get a lot more than tickets. What we're doing is we're doing a Kickstarter campaign with really great rewards. And a lot of the rewards are non-physical rewards, not like t-shirts or coffee mugs. They're experiences, once-in-a-lifetime experiences, backstage tours, behind-the-scene tours of things in the Bay Area that otherwise they wouldn't have access to. So check that out. Look for a great reward. Donate. It's a great cause. Any extra funds that we raise is going to go to science education. Tucker and Juliana, they produce events. The events are live, usually free,
yes,
and always videotaped and always available for free download later. So
you did something on the science of magic once, didn't you?
The neuroscience of magic. With Adam Gazzelli, a great neuroscientist, and he explained how the brain worked, and I tricked the brain.
Yes, you do. Okay, there's a lot more magic to magic than you would think.
Yes.
And a lot more reality that is worth knowing. All right, thank you. I can't wait to see
thank you
perform next. Thank you, dear. This is Janet Gallen saying, until next time, goodbye, and thank you for listening. And just remember, there is always a reason to write a love letter, and if you can do one that has a lot about the times you live in and what you do, just interspersed, you will be really contributing to history. Somebody will be grateful down the line, and somebody will be grateful tomorrow to get that letter. So until next time, bye-bye.